Secretary of State's office and Mr. Chisholm with the title insurance people, and we think that the amendments that are before you at the present time will satisfy the problem as we see it. The one question that the Secretary of State's office raised is the procedural effect on this, and we do not want to tinker with the procedural way. I think they've worked out that as to the effect of subsequent filings and things that way. We want to make it perfectly clear that our only intent is to make a certain that there are the two categories that a person might apply for. The amendments as I see them, and I think Mr. Chisholm has reviewed them very carefully, we agree that they would do the job they were set out to do.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Jan Sullivan, Director of Public Records for the Secretary of State's office. We have no problem with the amendments. We would like to ask if there could be an effective date of January 188 attached to this, and it would give us sufficient time to get our computer system in operation to accommodate these changes.
Okay. Mr. Rawls, do you see any problem with that? Okay. Mr. Chisholm?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Craig Chisholm, Oregon Land Title Association, these amendments take care of the problems we initially saw with the bill, and so we're willing to sign off on it.
Great. Any further questions from committee members? Representative Hanlon?
Is the effect of these amendments to create two kinds of financing statements?
There'd be one type of financing statement, Representative Hanlon. There'd just be a two-tier. There'd be one for 5 years, which would be the same as the one for 10 years. But a person having a more than a five-year security interest in it would opt to take the 10-year rather than the five-year. And it would alleviate that person from having to refile after 5 years.
Do I take that as no, there aren't more than one kind, but yes, there's one for five and one for ten?
No, that's
that was
no.
Real confusing to me.
Yeah. Intended to be.
Let's try it one more time. Ms. Chisholm, do you want to take a
there is language in here that apparently would indicate that there would be two different, probably you'd have end up with two different pieces of paper. Because one of the UCC filing statements will have at the bottom of it, this financing statement is for 10 years, for effective for a period of 10 years from the date of filing. The other one would not have that. So, yes, there would be greater complexity
another
in that
question,
regard.
Another question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hanlon.
Jan, you're saying that you're sure, representing the Secretary of State's office, that that's just fine with you?
Representative Hanlon, what we would propose to do is retain our forms as they currently are for the five-year status and create a new UCC-1 form to accommodate the 10-year filing.
Is that a yes?
Pardon, I'm sorry.
Is that a yes to my question?
Yes.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Yes, it is.
Okay. Are there further questions, inquiries regarding the amendments? Representative Hanlon, a motion on the amendments?
I'll move the amendments.
Thank you. Representative Hanlon moves the amendments to HB 2297-4. And Representative Hanlon, may I include with that a further conceptual amendment adding a new Section 4, which would prescribe the effective date of January 1st, 1988. Parties are all indicating that that's acceptable. Okay, it is so moved. Is there further discussion? Is there any objection to those amendments? If not, so ordered. Representative Hanlon?
Move the bill with a due pass to the full committee.
Thank you. Representative Hanlon moves House Bill 2297 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Thank you all for your assistance. Appreciate it very much. If there's no further discussion, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Hanlon?
Aye.
Votes aye. Motion's adopted. We're going to return briefly to the hearing on 3348 before we take up our last bill on work session 3069. Mr. Pfeiffer has been able to rejoin us, and I believe that you wish to testify against the bill as introduced. Mr. Pfeiffer.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you for coming back to the bill. My name is Stephen Pfeiffer, Assistant Attorney General, Oregon Department of Justice. In that capacity, I serve as Chief Criminal Attorney in the Appellate Division. I want to address what we have considered to be some serious problems with the bill as written. We feel this bill currently would significantly expand the right of criminal defendants to file delayed appeals. The Department of Justice opposes it for several reasons. First, we feel there's already an adequate means of dealing with late appeals through post-conviction relief. A criminal defendant can get a delayed full, that is, plenary appeal, if the defendant shows that his counsel was ineffective in failing to file a notice of appeal. Also, he must show that there would be some arguable merit to the appeal. In other words, he could not simply file a frivolous appeal on something which would be totally not subject to ordinary criminal appeal. In a post-conviction hearing, there would be an evidentiary hearing. The state would have the right of discovery, could subject the criminal defendant or the petitioner in post-conviction to deposition, and in other words, could defend against the action. House Bill 3348, as we read it, requires a delayed appeal regardless of merit if the defendant shows that the failure to file was not his fault. That is, in most cases, that would mean that it's simply his attorney's fault that the appeal wasn't filed. Our first question is, what is this showing? It doesn't define the meaning of the term showing. If this type of showing is equivalent to the showing made in a post-conviction hearing, then it has some serious problems. The Court of Appeals is not equipped to handle a factual or evidentiary question of this type. The state, I assume, would be able to respond in writing to the motion, but the state would be ill-equipped to respond in the same way it would in a post-conviction hearing. That is, it could not present contrary evidence and could not subject the criminal defendant to deposition. It has the potential for simply a conclusory statement on the part of the defendant that it wasn't his fault, it was his attorney's fault, and therefore he's entitled to an appeal. And the obvious contrast with post-conviction, as I've already noted, the merit of the appeal, as I stated, is immaterial under this proposal. It could very well open the floodgates to even more frivolous appeals. I think it's no secret that in Oregon we're really flooded with frivolous appeals with no merit whatsoever, most of them involving excessive sentence claims, but in the hands of a pro se defendant, a penitentiary inmate representing himself or herself, the sky's the limit as far as what they could bring up in a late appeal. Also, there's no time limit, and I think this is probably the most significant factor of all. There's no time limit in this bill. A criminal defendant could do this 5, 10, 15 years down the road and be able to prove that or make this showing, whatever this showing is, that he did not file it through no fault of his own. The statute ORS 137.020 sub 3 already requires that a criminal defendant be informed at the time of sentencing as to what his appeal rights are and the procedure he is to follow to perfect an appeal. This bill could either make that meaningless, or if you were to tie the two together, that requirement could make this bill meaningless. Because let me give an example. If most defendants are required at the time of sentencing to sign a form indicating that they have been advised of their appeal rights, if they sign that form and they fail to make any means to take any appropriate action to file their appeal, then that would deem to be a waiver of their appeal rights, and that the state would be capable of arguing that in post-conviction relief. And my question would be, and this is sort of an open question, and that is whether what effect that would have in conjunction with this bill. just to give you an idea of how, what impact this could possibly have, and there's no way that we can tell right now how many criminal defendants are not filing appeals who would file appeals under this bill. I don't have any statistics on how many appeals are delayed appeals after post-conviction relief, but this bill would certainly broaden that to include more than just those types of appeals, but could include any type of delayed appeal by a pro se inmate or any other type of criminal defendant. We have 15 attorneys in the appellate division who do either criminal appeals either on a full or a part-time basis. And those 15 attorneys in February, for example, we had 1,020 active criminal cases on appeal. In March, we had 1,040. In February, we had 119 additional criminal cases come into our office. In March, an additional 137. I give you that just as an indication of the size of the criminal appellate caseload in the Department of Justice. In this biennium, on average, 10 more briefs have been filed per month than in the last biennium, than were filed in the last biennium. We feel we don't need any more frivolous appeals, and we don't need any more delayed appeals of this nature, especially by pro se inmates. That causes even more work than if they were represented by counsel. We don't believe that defeat of this bill as presently written would violate a defendant's rights. The defendant in a meritorious case can still file post-conviction for post-conviction relief and get a delayed appeal if the case has any arguable merit and if he can show ineffective assistance of counsel. That's basically all I have, unless there are questions.
Okay. Steve, I don't know if you had a chance to review or hear what Mr. Nass...
He and I spoke earlier, so I have a feeling
okay.
What
I
he said.
I don't know if my sense is that his purpose was somewhat more limited than the language may suggest.
I think it was.
And I would encourage you two to, if you can work up any amendments, if you feel that would be a fruitful process... to narrow the scope, I would invite you to do so. However, that decision is in your hands, gentlemen.
Right. In that regard, I just say one thing. I would welcome an amendment that would limit it to say 60 or 90 days, so we can get some handle, some limit on the time factor involved here, and that the defendant would be required to make a specific type of showing as to why the appeal wasn't filed. Thank you.
Steve, are there any Department of Justice bills which would limit the, I guess what you would characterize as an excessive opportunity to file frivolous appeals in criminal matters? Or are you aware of any legislation that...
Not specifically.
Okay.
The issue comes up every session before
well,
the doing...
Chief Judge has, in this committee and down in Ways and Means and other... opportunities, I think every chance he gets, has spoken to the caseload of the Court of Appeals, particularly as it relates to de novo review, but mm-hmm. he's also made it pretty clear to us that these, what some would characterize as frivolous appeals, are a substantial part of the workload, although it may be more churning paper and files than other sort of intellectual kind of work that's required. And
I know.
He's been invited, and I'd certainly extend the same invitation to you folks. If you have any ideas or of any merit that might reduce what I think most would agree are truly frivolous appeals, we'd certainly be glad to hear those ideas.
All right. The only bill I know of, and I can't recall the number, is a bill which would prevent defendants in criminal cases from stripping the trial court of jurisdiction while they file a frivolous and meritless interlocutory appeal. There's a bill that would remedy that situation, which has the potential to be a real bombshell, in especially in criminal trials. Thank
okay.
you.
Any further questions? If not, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Anyone else on 3348? Okay, if not, let's return to work session on 3069. I understand we may have some amendments. And I believe we have some folks who are here who are testified earlier as proponents. And I'd invite those folks, as well as those who may have an interest in amendments that are being discussed, to go ahead and come forward to the witness table. Representative Dix, I believe you've prepared a set of amendments. Would you like to review those with us?
Actually, if I could, I'd like to ask Mr. Fedanke to go through that set of amendments with us.
Okay. Mr. Bradley, I don't know if you've seen a copy of those amendments.
I have not.
Could someone favor Mr. Bradley with a copy of those, possibly?
What are those ACLU amendments?
Go ahead and get Fedanke. 3069-2.
Okay, Mr. Fedanke, if you want to go ahead and review the amendments dash two with us, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Should be identified as your amendments. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Thank you. Go ahead.
For the record, I'm David Fedanke, Associate Director, ACLU of Oregon. At our request, and at the request of Representative Dix, Legislative Council prepared the amendments that are before you. 3069-2, dated 4/22/87. These amendments essentially replace the bill as introduced. They retain many of the provisions of the original bill, but because of the number of technical changes that were necessary as a result of some of the changes we wanted to make, Legislative Council felt it was simpler to just redo the entire proposal. What we have done in comparing it with the bill as introduced, the first change comes in Section 1, where we deleted gambling from the list of offenses. And our idea was in discussing this issue around the state, it has generally been put forward as a proposal designed to get a handle on drug problems, and we felt it would be useful to limit it to that in this situation. The next major change shows up on page 2 of the printed bill and also on page 2 of the amendments before you, which is the deletion of real property, subsection G in the original bill, as being subject to forfeiture. Under the original bill, the whole or any of any lot or tract and appurtenances or improvements, which was used to commit or facilitate the commission of illegal activity, could be forfeited. We have suggested that the forfeiture of real property be limited to situations where the property or the equity in the property is traceable to the proceeds of the illegal activity.
Dave, Mr. Chair,
Representative Dix,
can you go over that one more time? Because I think that I know Representative Bunn had some concerns in this particular issue, as did I when we had a public hearing on it. So can you walk us back through the differences between this bill and the amendment?
The provision which we have removed showed up on the printed version of the bill on page 2, lines 8 through 10, and provided that real property, including the right, title, and interest in the whole of any lot or tract of land and any appurtenances or improvements, which is the proceeds of, or is used to commit or facilitate the commission of any illegal activity. And that would include, for example, property. Let me just give you a hypothetical. If someone had 100 acres of land in a rural area and a portion of that property were used to cultivate marijuana, the provision in the original bill would allow the local agency to seize the entire property, regardless of whether there had been any continuing criminal enterprise, regardless of whether the entire property had been used for illegal activity. If any portion of the property was used for the illegal activity, the entire property could be seized and taken by the local government under subsection G in the original bill. What we are suggesting is that the forfeiture of real property be limited to circumstances under which the state can show that the property was purchased, or a portion of the property was purchased, with the proceeds from illegal activity. Is that clear?
Thank you.
We also deleted subsection 2 in section 2, which shows up immediately following that section in the printed bill, lines 11 through 13 on page 2 of the printed bill. We didn't believe that that section was necessary, and we've had some discussions with Mr. Bradley about whether that provision was necessary, and he's not sure. But we're open. If there is some reason to have that in there, we're open to reevaluating that. The other change that we made in this section of the printed bill was to take the provisions relating to conveyances, which showed up as section 2, subsection C, 1C, which starts on page 1 of the printed bill, lines 32 and 33, and continued on to line 1 of page 2 of the printed bill. And what we've done is to take the provisions relating to conveyances, add that as a new section 8 of the amendments, and expand the existing conveyance forfeiture statute, which appears in RS 167.247. That amendment shows up on page 5 of the printed amendments. And I'm sorry to be jumping around, but I think it's simpler to go through this in terms of what the printed bill did and the changes we made. We felt that there was no reason, since there is already a statute on the books relating to the forfeiture of conveyances in drug cases, we might as well keep it all in one place. And so what we have suggested is adding to the reasons for forfeiture of conveyances, conveyances which have been used to facilitate the unlawful manufacture or delivery of controlled substances. Under the existing statute, and this is an example that's been brought forward to me on a number of occasions in talking about this issue before local governments, in Lane County, for example, there has been someone who had a mobile speed lab, a van in which he manufactured methamphetamine. Under the existing statute, it's unclear whether the state has the authority to seize that van unless there are actually methamphetamines in the van at the time it is seized. If there are only precursor chemicals and lab equipment, and in other words, enough evidence to prove that, in fact, it is an illegal lab, under current law, there may not be the authority to seize it. And we have no problem with expanding the definition to include those kinds of situations. Remaining major change that we made was to provide that these forfeitures shall be forfeitures to the state rather than to the local governments. We have expressed concern to local governments around the state that have adopted local ordinances similar to this proposal before you, that there is an invitation to mischief if the seizing agencies, and particularly the law enforcement agencies, which will be responsible for these seizures, end up receiving the proceeds from the sale of these assets. We believe that as local governments, if they were to become dependent on this as a source of revenue for their budgets, that there would be a tendency to go after more marginal kinds of cases. We see no reason why these forfeitures should not go to the state, and the proceeds therefore going into the Conant School Fund.
Thank you, Mr. Fernanke. Is there any further testimony on either the amendments or the bill?
Yes, I think Mr.
Are you going to comment on his amendment?
Well, I'd like to comment on both sets.
That's fine.
Of amendments.
If I may, Chairman Dixon, members of the committee. Article, so you've got our amendments up there. They have my name on them, and the Oregon Financial Services Association. And really, what I Gary's been some drafting here about Mr. Bradley's concerned about, and his concerns are legitimate. The main thrust of the amendments I have are on page 2, line 13 through 19. A lot of these amendments are prepared out of frustration. There are 6 or 8 bills in the legislature whereby the law enforcement agencies have forfeiture provisions in those bills. And it seems to me that it would be helpful if the legislature would ask them what protection there is in there for the people who have an ownership in the property. That we seize somebody else's property and sold it like they did, we'd be indicted and put in jail for grand larceny. And they take property with impunity, and there's no provision for notice to the owners or anything else. And it seems to me that it can be a private citizen that sold a car, and they're taking a down payment, and people are paying, and they seize a car. They have no way of knowing where that car is. The person's in jail, perhaps, and the car is gone, and they aren't receiving the money for it. It can be, I represent the Oregon Financial Services Association, and it's a commercial loans that are made to them. And it seems to me like the burden ought to be on them to provide, to set forth a provision as to how anybody who has an ownership interest in that is going to know where the collateral or what they loan the money on is. And they don't do that. And it seems to me like this is a very reckless way to approach this. We file amendments, and they're kind of imperfect a lot of time. We have to come back up and change them, and because they're kind of a generic type of amendment trying to protect the real owners of the property. A lot of the time they have the people who have the property in their possession have a very minority interest in that property. The people who have the big ownership interest are the people they borrowed the money from to buy the vehicle, or the people who loaned it to them on credit and are sold it to them on credit. And they don't do that. And it seems to me like this is unfair to introduce legislation that way. Mr. Bradley has, on these overall amendments, has some legitimate concerns, and even on that portion on page 2 that appears lines 13 through 19. And this merely says that to protect those people who have filed or recorded in the public records, or it's on the certificate of title, that they have an interest in it. And we want them to do it, we say, immediately. Maybe that's not possible, but within a reasonable time, such as we've talked about, it seems like that's a very reasonable thing to ask. And I don't know why they would even bring in a bill here without having something in there to protect the property owners. What would be desirable would be if we had an overall statute someplace that nobody could seize anybody's property without notifying in a very reasonable period of time. And so we wouldn't have to worry about 6 or 8 bills that are flying around the legislature in various committees. And maybe we ought to put a burden on them to do that before they bring in any more bills like this. But going back to this bill, why this language with the modifications that Mr. Bradley and I have generally agreed upon will probably take care of it.
Mr. Chairperson, John Bradley, representing Mike Schrunk, Multnomah County District Attorney. As far as the amendments I'm concerned are the amendments made by the ACLU. I have not seen these amendments until today. I hate to ask things to be set over, but I will be asking that we set these over so I can look at the amendments a little bit more thoroughly. I'm concerned with some of the things that have been raised. The deletion of gambling, I don't know if that's how significant that is. I think, as I've indicated to Dave, that for the most part, if you have a long history of gambling, you basically generally have an enterprise and you generally have a racketeering activity, and you couldn't forfeit under all the ordinances anyway. And I think I kind of tried to explain that last time. The deletion of real property, we have a concern with that. I had some amendments that I thought had been sent down, perhaps had not. I don't have 12 I need. I've got.
Yeah, we got them. I got them. You got them?
I got them.
Everybody got them?
Everybody got them.
I think we got them.
What we did is the amendment we suggest on real property The language in 3069, unamended, it's fairly broad, and several members brought it up last time. But the what we've done is we have restricted that when we talk about real property to include those instances where it's real property, that it's basically narcotics, the manufacture of narcotics, it's done for